Well, for the next hour and a half, we have a wonderful session to kind of bring together all of the concepts that we discussed this morning. So I believe Dr. Bashinsky is going to start with the first case, and I'll just hand over the podium to him.
Thank you. Be cognizant, as you're eating your lunch, of the phosphate load that you are now ingesting, and telling your patients, of course, to avoid. And that's the first introduction to this first case. We each have two cases. We'll just go in a round robin. This is made to be interactive. So speak up. If you have a question, don't wait for me to ask for your question. Speak up. First patient. These are real patients, at least this is a real patient that I saw a number of years ago. 35-year-old white male, adult onset PKD. It was diagnosed at age 27 while he was in the Army. He was discharged for medical reasons, no follow-up. He was adopted, so unfortunately we have no family history. And he had a limited education and had a very poor understanding of his disease. Back pain, polyuria, did an ultrasound. The right kidney was large. The left kidney was larger. Numerous cysts. Bicarbonate concentration was 15, low, suggestive that he couldn't excrete his endogenous acids. His creatinine was 9.3, BUN 111. Calcium was 11. Phosphorus was 9.1, clearly elevated. His alkaphos was also up. We talked to the patient about phosphate binders. Unfortunately, he delayed getting access. And let's think about the calcium and phosphorus in this gentleman. You saw this slide already this morning, and I bring it up again because Jeff Block has a study from 1998. This is a similar study in 2004. Others have similar data. Multivariate adjusted, it's clear that an increase in serum phosphorus concentration is associated with an increase in the relative risk of death. A marked decrease in phosphorus is also associated with a significant increase in the relative risk of death. It's not a perfect study. As Miles said to us, we don't know about vitamin D, we don't know about a lot of other things, but clearly, would I rather have a phosphorus of 4 to 5 or greater than 9? It's clear which group I would rather be in. We also know that with calcium, the adjusted serum calcium is also a significant correlation. Higher calciums increase the risk of death. Lower calciums looks like it decreases the risk of death. So the hypocalcemia that I worry about in my dialysis patients, I don't worry about quite as much anymore. What I show these two slides for is for the following. There's very nice data now. This is an 01 cartoon, but there's, if you look at the current opinion in nephrology and hypertension outside, Shanahan has similar data to Garicelli on what happens to vascular smooth muscle cells. This is an aortic cell. As you increase phosphate, you increase the number of sodium phosphate co-transporters. I've been calling it NAPI, you can call it NPC. Increases intracellular phosphate. You have upregulation of several vascular smooth muscle cell genes, but CBFA-1, and goes up. I don't know if you can see the up arrow, but CBFA1 goes up, and this gene is clearly associated with mineralization, not only in vascular smooth muscle cells and bone cells, but renal tubular cells that are calcifying as well. You have elevated ALK-Fos, elevated calcium binding proteins, elevated collagen-rich extracellular matrix, and it's thought by some that you have these calcium phosphate-loaded matrix vesicles that move calcium into the collagen-rich extracellular matrix and mineralize it, and that the increased calcium and phosphorus in the blood leads to increased matrix mineralization. We are calcifying our dialysis patients. As you know, the risk of death in a 30-year-old dialysis patient is equal to that of a 75, 80-year-old non-dialysis patient by Foley's data, whether they're black, white, male, or female. And much of this is cardiovascular mortality, and we're starting to understand how an elevation in phosphorus and an elevation in calcium might increase cardiovascular mortality. End of lecture, back to case. 3 months later, the patient began on hemodialysis. Creatinine was 9.1. BUN was 134. It took this guy 3 months to get started on dialysis. Calcium remained elevated. Phosphorus also remained elevated. Many mistreatments, many abbreviated treatments. He was diagnosed as ADHD. We heard about ADH with water transport. We heard about ADH with autosomal dominant hypocalciuria or hypercalcemia. We now talk about ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. He had borderline intelligence on formal testing. He was admitted to the hospital 4 months later with a renal cyst, had Klebsiella. Calcium was elevated, phosphorus was elevated. His PTH was now over 1,000. His 125D level was low. His 25D level, which unfortunately we weren't smart enough to measure at the time, was also low. We did a parathyroid ultrasound. Right up, and you can see right upper pole, big parathyroid. Left upper pole, also big parathyroid. We saw one with the ultrasound on each. Chest x-ray, he had extensive soft tissue calcification. We couldn't use cinacalcet on him because it was before the cinacalcet error, and he refused parathyroidectomy, was clearly judged to be competent. I don't know how well you can see it, but this is pure calcification of his shoulder due to the extensive calcium phosphate raising the supersaturation through the mechanisms we've shown. You get calcification. He refused all meds. Intermittently showed up for dialysis. He finally agreed to a parathyroidectomy. He had calciphylaxis, ulcerations, multiple soft tissue. This is just more calcification, more calcification. At surgery, two glands, one centimeter and two centimeter on the left side. These are big glands. The right upper was 1.5 centimeters. The right lower could not be identified. Our surgeon looked at the entire lobe of his thyroid. He resected it on the right lower, couldn't find it. He re-implanted parathyroid tissue into the right forearm. You can judge whether he should have re-implanted tissue or he should have left one of these three big glands. That's personal preference. As long as you have a good surgeon, it doesn't matter what they do. Most surgeons are leaving some tissue behind. At day 6, the calcium had fallen a little and started to rise. The PTH is 972. What's going on? Don't all speak at once. I can't hear you. So what do you think is going on? I can't hear you, but I assume that all of you are thinking he has an accessory parathyroid gland. Okay, a small percentage, but not that small, of people have the fourth gland in the mediastinum, even in the abdomen, and you have to look for it because clearly this PTH should be trivial, but it's still 1,000. So we went looking. We did an MR of the neck, no evidence of the parathyroid gland, and then we did a subtraction scan. I'm going to show you in this case and another case why the sestamibi scan is better than the subtraction scan, and if your nuclear folks aren't doing it, you should convince them to do it. Intense activity in the inferior and to the right of the manubrial sternal joint. He continued to be noncompliant. Our psychiatry friends said that he was competent. This is, I guess, the sestamibi scan. You can see a parathyroid lighting up right there. You have to go after that, and you have to get that gland, otherwise the PTH will never fall. Our fellow wouldn't let us do it. He would drink large amounts of milk brought by the family. He would take milk off other patients' trays. A quart of milk is the best phosphate replacement. If you want oral phosphate replacement, it's a gram of phosphorus in a quart of milk. Give your patients milk to drink. The hypophosphatemia causing the respiratory paralysis that Miles told you about is also seen during refeeding from anything else. And the best therapy is simply milk. It's cheap. It's good. Patient made himself DNR, 11, 11. PTH was now up to 1,300 from that single gland. He became septic and hypotensive and died. They found the fourth parathyroid gland postmortem, exactly where the scan showed, and it was a big gland. A woman during the break told me about a very similar case, that they found three, they couldn't find the fourth, and the surgeon went looking for it in the mediastinum and couldn't find it. It's there. You just have to get the right surgeon. If you look at the gastric mucosa, we see some calcification. Why should there be calcification in the gastric mucosa? Think about the physiology of the gastric mucosa. Why do you often see calcification there? Because, I'm sorry? pH. Someone said pH, I think. Or maybe they said phosphate. As you secrete hydrogen ions into the lumen, you put a bicarbonate on the basolateral side. That bicarbonate will raise the pH. We know calcium phosphate is not as soluble in an alkaline milieu, and the patient calcifies the gastric mucosa. In the fundus, there's calcium. There's calcium in the vessels. There's calcium in the skin. This is clearly calciphylaxis. Here's the vessel with some calcification. And in the AV node even. And this patient died because of his high calcium and phosphorus, probably phosphorus more than calcium. And it's just to show you the ravages of high calcium and phosphorus and also of hyperparathyroidism. Questions and comments. You want this to be interactive. I'm sorry? Right. So if you have three big glands.
David, you have to repeat the question for the.
The question is, should the surgeon have checked intra-op PTH levels? That's a nice trick, but they couldn't find the fourth gland. So they knew it was. Absolutely. What the surgeon, the question is, before you implant more parathyroid tissue, should you make sure you have no parathyroid secretion? PTH has a half-life of minutes. You're going to see a very rapid fall in calcium in PTH. It might have made sense before you do the implantation to make sure the PTH level fell. You can always freeze the parathyroid tissue and implant it later. Works very well. Other questions? So that's a good comment. Other questions? So the question is, should you or should you not do ultrasound of the parathyroid glands? If you're going to be cost effective, you shouldn't do it. There is really, in this case, little reason to have done it. We're an academic institution, and if the resident orders it, I tend not to say don't do it. But you're absolutely right. There's really no reason to in a case like this, to go do pre-op ultrasound. There's no reason to do pre-op sestamibi scans, except if you're worried about that FHH that we've talked about so much this morning. Sir.
There are a few case reports regarding the role of bisphosphonates in calciphylaxis, and also there are several case reports of role of bisphosphonates and extravascular calcifications. I'm just wondering, like, is there any role of bisphosphonates in this case?
It's clear that calciphylaxis can be associated with a high and a low PTH. So in my mind, there's no role for parathyroidectomy, not in this case, but in the typical case of calciphylaxis.
I'm asking about
that. And I'll get to it. Okay, I promise I'll get to it. I'm just, a little attitude here. We'll get to your question. So the question he gets to with that preamble of an answer, you see, if you're up here, you do that so you can think while you're talking about something else. Is there a role of bisphosphonates? As far as I know, there's never been a controlled study. All of it is in the, as you say, in case reports. I could understand how it could work, but there's no data. So I don't advocate it.
I guess there are several case reports, case series in extravascular calcification, like infantile vascular calcification, they showed the bisphosphonates are useful. And there's a few studies showed it controls a refractory hyperparathyroidism. And there are several case series with, in addition, other than the vascular calcification, you know, dystrophic calcification is also right. Helpful. Okay. I guess it could be used. In this case, we did not have any option, I guess.
No, we didn't. And until there's a real controlled study, you have to understand with any case series, people publish what works. They don't publish what doesn't work. So what you see in the literature is a best case estimate of what possibly could happen. Until there's a controlled double-blind study, all bets are off. Sir.
There are some studies about use of sodium thiosulfate in calciphylaxis. Can these be used in these soft tissue calcifications?
In the soft tissue? You know, again, it's the same thing. It makes sense. It inhibits crystallization in the urine, but as far as I know, there's no clear data. So it gets into witchcraft. Do you think it works or not? Okay. Unfortunate case. In my mind, hyperphosphatemia is the biggest risk to our dialysis patients. We control it with calcium-containing binders to the limit as recommended by KDOQI and a large use of non-calcium-containing phosphate binders.
I have one slide. So you're going to help. 47-year-old woman, excuse me, African-American man, who is a smoker, referred by the primary care doctor to you for management of hypercalcemia. He has a past medical history of hypertension, for which he's treated with metoprolol. And 3 months earlier, he was started on hydrochlorothiazide because this came out in the journal as being life prolonging. Lab tests reveal that come with him, with the referral, sodium of 139, K of 3.2, chloride of 103, bicarb of 27. His renal function appears absolutely normal. Glucose is 104. The calcium is indeed high at 12.2. The phosphate is 4.4, and you rifle through the records, and you find that the serum calcium has been taking a slow, steady rise over the last year and a half, from a high normal 9.7, subsequently 9.9 a year ago, and 6 months ago it was still within the normal range, but again at the high end. That's the case. So, what are the possibilities? What tests should we order, and then what is the treatment? So let me go back and just leave that posted. So I guess the first step is, where do we start? So I think the place we start is what they sent the patient to us for and what is the most outstanding lab value that's presented, and that's obviously the hypercalcemia. So what do we need to do? PTH, somebody, many people, yeah. Could you just stop the thiazide is one possibility. So I think what you might be proposing is what one of the issues that comes out of this case is, that is the thiazide what's responsible for this thing taking off in only the last few months? Because it was really somewhat stable, although slowly rising, but in the last 3 months this has become a calcium of 12.2, and clearly the thiazides could be implicated as exacerbating it. Do you think that the thiazides are accounting for the whole problem? Possible, but not likely. So certainly one thing would be to get rid of the thiazide. Okay, so somebody wanted to order a PTH. Anybody want to order an ionized calcium, just to be sure? I think we ought to have one of those in our pocket, right? When you evaluate hyponatremia once, you just want to make sure that the osmolality is actually low too. And then you go down the whole pathway. It's annoying to have to remember it after you've done a million tests and not have an answer. So let's say the ionized calcium here was on the high side. Let's say it was 1.44, okay? So we are, in fact, talking about hypercalcemia. So somebody wants to order a PTH, but before we get to ordering tests, what things are crossing your mind based on the information we know? What? So cancer is one possibility. If it was cancer, what type of mechanism would you be proposing? PTH-mediated? Not PTH-mediated, PTHRP-mediated. So what are typical players for that? What? Squamous cell carcinomas of the lung, certainly he's a smoker, that's a possibility. Renal cell would be a good one. Breast cancer is pretty rare in men, but it occasionally happens, but that would be the big one in women. Okay, so that's good. Anything argue against that? The phosphate level, what would you anticipate? It should be high? It should be low, right. Because if you have excessive unregulated activation of either PTH or PTHRP, one would anticipate lowish phosphates. Maybe they're not going to be terribly low, but they certainly shouldn't be on the higher side as it is in this case. Most people have a serum phosphate between 2.5 and 4.5, but that means there's plenty of people down around 2.7, 3. So this is a little high-ish. And of course, the other thing just to make sure is that the serum creatinine is 0.8. Because if the serum creatinine was 1.7, you might not put as much weight in the serum phosphate not being low, right? So that makes it more believable. So that's one possibility, certainly a malignancy, so we're going to need to get a chest x-ray, no doubt. Anything else? Who? Vitamin D intoxication was proposed. I'm sorry, I can hear preferentially what's closer to me, but vitamin D intoxication, so let's see, would that be a possibility? So that would give you hypercalcemia, certainly. Would that give you a phosphate? Could the phosphate be explained by that here? You might expect a highish phosphate, but I could live with that. That's not too bad. When you have vitamin D intoxication and hypercalcemia, often with hyperphosphatemia, what's the renal function typically? It's usually not pristine. This has the makings of something chronic rather than that acute presentation with a milk alkali syndrome. But that's certainly a possibility, so we could consider getting what test to address that. How do you measure what? 25D, somebody said? Yeah, so 25D is how you always assay the storage form of vitamin D, so that would be on the list of possibilities. What else? Going back to cancers, we left that quickly. Sarcoid, somebody said. Let's come back to sarcoid. PTHRP, we said, is a possibility. Any other possible etiologies of malignancy? Myeloma. So could myeloma fit this? Certainly. A little young, 47 years old. Maybe if he was HIV positive, then it would really be possible. Then you can get those myelomas down into the 30s and 40s. But it's possible. The phosphate is okay with that. The lack of renal dysfunction is fine. Of course, many cases of myeloma present with renal dysfunction, but they don't have to. And the issue we brought up with the anion gap this morning is cute if you find it, but if it's not there, it doesn't rule out myeloma by any means. So that's something worth considering. So almost anybody who steps foot in a nephrologist's office ends up with an SPEP and a UPEP, so we'll get that too. Okay. And now what about sarcoid? Who's the sarcoid champion? What's your thoughts? Possible? So you'd expect high-ish calcium and phosphate, so that's reasonably consistent. What about demographically? Is sarcoid, this is exactly when you see it, right? African-Americans, sort of in their 30s and 40s, that'd be perfect. No shortness of breath, no cough, nothing like that. Does that rule out sarcoid? No, of course not. It can be mostly extra pulmonary, or it certainly can be pulmonary, but it can actually be pulmonary and the patient has no symptoms. So a chest x-ray is certainly going to help us because hyalurolymphadenopathy would be of value. Sarcoid can also give you a tubular interstitial disease that can actually present with the renal dysfunction out of proportion to the other abnormalities. Granulomatous tubular interstitial disease, but that's pretty uncommon. Okay, and what would you do to assess for sarcoid? 125D levels? ACE level? Yeah. Let's start with the physiology first. The physiology is you're looking for what in sarcoid? What physiology are you trying to capture? You're trying to capture excess activation of vitamin D by granuloma leading to what? Excessive calcium absorption. And what's the footprint of excessive calcium absorption in the steady state? Excessive calciuria. So I would rather do a functional test. You know, you go down the road and get an ACE test. You know, they do that in the case records of the New England Journal of Medicine. It's always negative. But, you know, that's already the next tier when you're reaching. What you want to do is capture the physiology first, and then once you know the physiology, then your list is much shorter of possibilities. So I think a 24-hour urine, calcium, and if you're impatient, you might want to get a spot urine for creatinine and calcium, and you might as well get protein while you're at it. And so that sounds good. So in fact, this is what I am getting at indeed. This is sarcoidosis. And what I'm trying to show you is somebody who's had smoldering sarcoidosis that hasn't yet come to clinical attention. They're in the hypercalciuric stage that they often are in before they develop the overt hypercalcemia. And in this patient, what triggered the crossing of the line to the development of hypercalcemia was the addition of the thiazide diuretic that interfered with the calciuria and then led to the hypercalcemia. What's the treatment? So chest x-ray, bilateral hyalurolymphadenopathy, by the way. And so you don't even need the ACE test. You got your answer if you want to. And then if you want to prove it with a tissue diagnosis, you send them to your pulmonologist and they throw the bronch down there and get you your answer, 1, 2, 3. Steroids. So the treatment, steroids. That's Dr. Andrus. You can do well on the boards. So steroids would be the treatment of the hypercalcemia in sarcoidosis, absolutely. And in this case, I agree with the very first comment that you all made, which was getting rid of the hydrochlorothiazide in this case. There's all kinds of antihypertensive choices that we can give somebody. And so certainly in this patient, we'd want to avoid something that causes hypercalciuria. Okay, any questions? FHH being in the differential. I suppose it's possible. It's always, but you guys are very, very fixated on FHH this whole morning. It's very rare, but
sarcoid's
pretty unusual too. I suppose. I guess it could be, but again, your 24-hour urine is gonna take care of you. By the way, the other follow-up test to nail the physiology is once you have the hypercalciuria, this is one of the rare circumstances where measuring a 125D is not a horrendous idea. You may not need to do it because if all the footprints are there and you make a tissue diagnosis, it's not that important. But that is a situation when you're looking for excessive activation of 125D, it's useful sometimes like this to measure it. Where it's not useful is when you're hypothesizing that there's deficiency of 125. See, because if you're looking for a syndrome, let's say secondary hyperpara due to vitamin D deficiency, And this is the most important reason of why you shouldn't measure 125 routinely in kidney patients and in vitamin D deficient patients. Because what happens is, when you're vitamin D deficient, let's say your 25 D level is 6, what does that do to your PTH? It leads to an increase in PTH through a variety of mechanisms, some more direct, some more indirect. But at the end of the day, the PTH goes up, and that's the secondary hyperparathyroidism. What does that secondary hyperparathyroidism in turn do to renal 1-alpha hydroxylase? It stimulates it. And it turns out that 25D stores, if you look at the units, they're in nanograms per ml, whereas 125D levels are in picograms. So it's a thousandfold higher. And so if you have lots of PTH activation, even in the setting of 25D deficiency, that PTH can lead to a higher percent of activation of 25 to 125, and it'll actually eke the 125 level into the low normal range. And so if you did it, you'd say, there's nothing wrong here, and you'd be making a big mistake. In fact, that vitamin D deficiency is the root cause of the problem. It's the exact same logic when you're talking about hypothyroidism. A T3 and T4 that's in the normal range with a TSH of 90 is very, very abnormal. So it's the same idea.
If, for the question on the FHH, all you need is a PTH level. If it's high 125D, what should the PTH be?
It's suppressed. That's right. Somebody said it was low. That's actually a great point.
Zero. So that's all you need to make.
Because the calcium sensing receptor is active and it's telling the PTH not to secrete in the setting of the hypercalcemia, and you've isolated the problem. That's a great point I didn't make. Thank you. Yes?
Amir Alamir from Cleveland. I wonder why would you treat this patient with steroids? Before hydrochlorothiazide, calcium loss 10.1, patient is completely asymptomatic.
Fair enough. I would certainly give it a trial to see what happened off the thiazide. All the while, I'd be trying to make my diagnosis. But there are several potential things that could happen. One is that there could be chronic hypercalciuria that could ultimately lead to stone disease and to calcification in the kidney, which could potentially be a problem. Big picture-wise, if you are going to treat somebody with hypercalcemia that becomes symptomatic and it's due to this syndrome, it's going to be via steroids. Not to mention that steroids are sometimes, not always, useful for managing the underlying sarcoidosis. But having said that, I think you could certainly make a case for taking off the thiazide and see where things settled out before you went and did that. But ultimately, you may end up there. Yes, in the back, in the cheap seats. What about bone metastatic disease? Yeah. So the mechanism of hypercalcemia and what we've termed bone metastases is almost always, most of these cases are due to humoral hypercalcemia malignancy. They're usually PTHRP mediated. So this direct metastasis from bone causing a tremendous amount of hypercalcemia, it certainly can happen, but it's not as common as the humeral mediated syndrome. So I suppose it's a possibility, but and you would be able to sort through those things with some of the diagnostic tests we postulated. But if you were going to propose that it was due to a squamous cell carcinoma with overwhelming bone metastases, then that would be the mechanism, would still be PTHRP in virtually all of them.
Okay.
Very good. You're up.
Okay. Do I need this? Okay. Well, this was an interesting patient that came into my osteoporosis clinic in December. He had a 6-month history of progressive arm, leg, and rib pain associated with generalized weakness, not associated with any kind of trauma. Review of systems was only positive for intermittent nausea and vomiting, decreased appetite, and weight loss. In fact, he had lost about 30 pounds over 4 months. Past medical history, very significant for having had or having HIV disease for the past 10 years. And his current medications included those shown here as part of the heart regimen. in addition to fairly hefty doses of naproxen for his pain and a little bit of codeine. On exam, he was very thin appearing. He came in wheelchair, no adenopathy. Chest exam, he had definite point tenderness over the left anterior 7th and 10th ribs and the right 4th and 10th ribs. Extremities, there was mild to moderate tenderness of biceps and triceps. He had symmetrically decreased muscle strength, lower extremities more so than upper extremities. Neurologically, he was non-focal, DTRs were normal, no real abnormalities there. Labs, sodium 140, potassium 3.5, chloride 115, CO2 13, creatinine 1, glucose normal, albumin normal, calcium 8.5, phosphate 0.7, and magnesium 1.7 milliequivalents per liter. His UA done by the lab was 3 plus glucose, 2 plus protein, and a urine pH of 5.5. So additional serologies were obtained. Got a CPK because of the muscle tenderness, and it was normal. GOT was normal, but his ALK FOS was 332, the upper normal limit for our lab of 130. That was fractionated into bone ALK FOS of 99 with an upper normal limit of 30. Serum uric acid was 1.7. Lipase was 85. He had had a bone scan before he came to osteoporosis clinic. I think that's why he got into our clinic. The technetium scan showed diffuse tracer uptake in the skull, focal uptake in the right humeral head, right 2nd, 4th, and 10th ribs, left 7th, 10th, and 11th ribs, right proximal tibia, and the left greater trochanter. So, what does this patient have? I hear a prox, I hear an R, T. Okay, next case. Should I repeat the answer? No, let's let it go a little longer. I've got another 10 minutes. We got to drag this out. Did somebody already talk about this earlier? Now, come on. Nobody? Okay. Not this one? Okay. Well, all right. Let's look at the labs. Chloride is 13. I can keep my finger going. Okay. Chloride is 13. CO2 is 13, sorry. Chloride 115. So you calculate the gap and it's 12. So it's a non-gap acidosis. Urine pH is 5.5. So it's probably not a distal RTA. Of course, we've already ruled out that the patient doesn't have diarrhea by history, the most common cause of metabolic non-gap acidosis. So this has already put us into a ballpark of not a distal RTA. What's really revealing about this is you've got hypophosphatemia that you don't typically see very often in osteoporosis clinic. And what's very telling about this UA is the 3 plus glucose in someone who's not diabetic. So he's got glycosuria, renal glycosuria. So you're exactly right. He's got a proximal RTA or Fanconi syndrome with heavy phosphate wasting. And notice that the phosphate is lower than the mag because of what I told you before. Mag is not really processed in the proximal tubule, it's in the thick ascending limb. So hypophosphatemia is his major problem. or at least it was the original metabolic problem that really led to his major problem. What's his major problem? It's on the bone scan. I got you stumped there. Did somebody say osteomalacia? No, sir? Yes, sir. Yeah. Now, you can't make a diagnosis of osteomalacia with this scan. The only way you can actually do that is with a bone biopsy. And we came very close to doing it in him, but his whole constellation fits so well with osteomalacia that's already been reported in the literature being associated with Fanconi syndrome that we didn't feel like we absolutely had to do it. But this is a very typical, and I'm sorry I didn't have the picture to be able to show you, but this is very typical diffuse, but usually kind of focal uptake of hot spots where you're having increased bone formation but no mineralization. And the other biochemical features of this is elevated bone alkaline phosphatase. So what's remarkable about him is that he lived with this for 6 months or more, and nobody really noticed that he had been acidotic all this time until he came to the bone clinic and just happened to see a nephrologist. At any rate, you're right, this is tenofovir-associated Fanconi syndrome. It's probably the 20th case since a report just came out in the literature this August reviewing all of the other 19 cases of tenofovir-associated Fanconis. This has all come about within since 2002. So it looks like it's a really potentially big problem that everybody should be paying attention to. Now, when you review these cases, not all of them are this blatant with severe acidosis like he had, which, by the way, I'll just finish up the case. We tried to treat him as an outpatient initially with like 360 milliequivalents of oral sodium oral citrate a day, or bicarb, and sodium phosphate, and he did okay. The problem was that he had so much pain and he wouldn't get off the naproxen that he started having nausea and vomiting, just wouldn't take anything. So I had to bring him in the hospital, pump him up IV with bicarb phosphate, did an EGD, no ulcer, just some gastritis, put him on PPIs, metoclopramide, and his stomach did fine. This, all these abnormalities corrected fairly quickly. They did take him off his heart regimen for 2 months while we corrected all the biochemical abnormalities and watched the bone alk phos drop from 99 down to 40 in 6 weeks. Very dramatic. And during the time about halfway through that he became hypocalcemic, requiring high dose calcitriol and calcium. His bone pain disappeared within 2 to 3 weeks, and he was up walking around, and we saw him in clinic just last week. He's been off of all medications for several months. All of his electrolyte abnormalities are now normalized, and he has been back on a new heart regimen without tenofovir for a month and a half. And so it looks like by adding back on everything except the tenofovir, and I think they added one other one here, DDI, he's done fine. So it is looks like it's fairly common if we're seeing this many already. And I think you need to be on the outlook. One other clinical pearl that I picked up from this review, it appears that of the 19 cases that have been associated with tenofovir related disease, 14 of the 19 also had ritonavir. And ritonavir apparently causes increased accumulation of tenofovir in the proximal tubule. So it may be that a learning point from this case, although it's not an exclusive association, is that this may not be the ideal heart therapy to go for, at least initially. Any questions? Yeah, that's a great question. Oh, the question is, hypophosphatemia is often associated with rhabdomyolysis, and how low does the phosphate have to be? Well, I mentioned that his phosphate was 0.7, and actually that falls into the range of what we call severe hypophosphatemia, and that is the point where you start seeing breakdown of muscle tissue, red cell membrane, deformation, hemolytic anemia, and all these other things that go wrong. Why his CPK was not elevated, I don't know. But I think it's a timed effect, so he may not have been that low for that long, is my only guess. But he's definitely in the range where you would give him IV phosphate normally. And I debated, actually, when I first saw him about bringing him in right away because of that. But I did have a repeat phosphate done within a few days as an outpatient, and it had already come up to about 1.5. So he responded very quickly to oral phosphate therapy. That was easy to treat, interestingly. It was the acidosis that was very hard to treat. And rightly so, it's Fanconi. So whatever you put in eventually gets dumped out. And we did document that his urine pH did go up to 7 during that therapy. So again, further support for Fanconi's.
Well, I have a question, but I'll wait my turn.
Question, I believe, had to do with how to give IV phosphate short-term, 2 or 3 hours versus long-term. Was that it? I don't know that I've played around with any kind of short-term therapy. It's usually a certain dose over 8 hours and then repeat that. I mean, I don't know. David, do you have a comment on that?
When you dialyze someone, the vast majority of phosphate is removed in the first 2 hours because of miscible pools of phosphorus, and then it comes down very slowly over the next 2 or 4 or 6 hours. If you take the converse of that, of giving back phosphorus, you probably achieve a lot of phosphate repletion acutely, but once you fill those miscible pools, it'll go slowly. So most of us tend to give phosphorus over more prolonged periods of time. And I again push to drink milk.
A more general question. In kind of evaluating hypophosphatemia, do you guys use fractional excretions of phosphorus? And if so, can you give some values as to what you think is low and high?
Well, I don't use them that much, but I just did a study where I looked at this stuff so I can at least give you an answer. Usually hypophosphatemia that I see, most of it's in the acute setting, in which case you're not in a steady state and urinary output is not as helpful, and you can usually figure out readily that it's from rhabdo or whatever it is, something acute. But when we did this study in very early kidney disease, the background fractional excretion of phosphate is between 10 and 20%. And then as people lost nephrons, it went up from there substantially. So for whatever that's worth, I don't know if that'll be that helpful. I think it's only going to be useful really in chronic situations like this. But you already had the clue that you knew it was renal wasting based on the glycosuria and the absence of hyperglycemia and the other clues that Dennis pointed out.
And my question was, when we see folks with tenofovir-related problems, should it be our universal recommendation to discontinue the drug? Now, clearly in this case, this fellow had a lot of problems, but I find myself frequently in the position of phosphorus is a little bit low, but there's a huge viral resistance pattern that suggests that the patient has limited options.
I have really no experience dealing with these drugs. This is probably the first patient, so I always have to go to my infectious disease colleagues. I did call them, and we were going to try to do this as an outpatient, but he got so sick so quickly, we just decided to bring him in and make that decision. They decided to just take him off everything. I don't know.
Does either of you have any experience in this? I guess there's one case report in the literature where someone had just very minor tubular problems that progressed. They just got caught early, and that the natural history of this is that the tubular problems just develop the longer you stay on the drug, which might be a matter of, you know, detection bias when someone finally noticed they had all these problems.
This review article that reviewed these cases did show for tenofovir-related, the disease can strike anywhere from 1 to 26 months after being on the drug, even though a little more than half, it usually occurred within the four to 8 month period, much like he was, 7 months. But 2 years out, that's really long. So it kind of, you know, everybody's a little bit different. Some of the case reports I read had kind of mild hypophosphatemia, not real severe. And like I said, many of them didn't have their very bad acidosis. So I think there's probably a range of disease phenotype, if you will, and how much it involves these other agents that actually causes more accumulation of tenofovir probably is related as well.
The other circumstance where the same kind of thing comes up is in people with refractory CMV. And you see that sometimes post-transplant, but often it's in, not so much now, but with so much good heart therapy, but previously with CMV was with foscarnet, which has some of the same problems, and cidofovir, which was a CMV drug on which this tenofovir is then based. And those people who need those drugs are often at the end of the line in terms of resistance against ganciclovir, and it sometimes happens in transplant patients. And we had one, and we gave them the foscarnet, and we knew we'd get the tubular abnormality as well. We ended up getting a crescentic glomerulonephritis too. But again, the point is that you can see all kinds of problems in the CMV side of it, and it comes to the same decision. Can you take them off? You may not be able to.
Fair enough.
Yeah, we quantitated it as urine protein was less than a gram of protein, so it was mainly amino acids, not albumin, so he didn't have a glomerular defect. It was all tubular.
Thank you, sir.
You have to look for Fanconi's, and it's a good thing the patient ran into you.
A 46-year-old female, adult onset diabetes, 20 years duration, diabetic retinopathy, diabetic gastroenteropathy. This patient was referred to us after the kidney biopsy was done. We would not have done this biopsy. So don't yell at me for the biopsy. This is how the patient came to us.
The resident ordered it.
No. Unfortunately, a nephrologist who didn't take this course probably ordered it. Hemodialysis was begun. Plus 3 months, the patient was found to be hypercalcemic, was on some calcium carbonate, on some renal gel, and the physical exam was essentially normal. At the time dialysis started, the calcium was 10.6, the phosphorus was 7.8. What do you think? That's the day the patient started dialysis. A high calcium. You would expect, as the patient was developing renal CKD and renal failure, that calcium to be on the lower side of normal. But yet the calcium is elevated. The phosphorus doesn't bother me very much. A lot of patients come into dialysis a little hyperphosphatemic. We start them on binders, and about 50% of the patients don't get below 6.4. Plus 3 months, when we saw the patient, the calcium was up to 12.2. By our assay, the alk phos was up a little bit. Aluminum wasn't interesting. The PTH was 200. What do you think?
primary hyperpara. So I'll sit down and we can go on to the next case. Absolutely. The patient was sent to us and they were concerned with a high calcium in the face of initiating dialysis. Calcium stayed up, phosphorus stayed up. Let's talk about the PTH assay, which we promised before. This is parathyroid hormone 1 to 84. How is a PTH assay done? You, in general, have a solid phase with a capture antibody. You take the solid phase is essentially a test tube. The capture antibody is adherent to the test tube and is sticking out. You put the parathyroid, you put the serum in, you shake it up, you pour off the serum. What will remain is parathyroid hormone that's adherent to the solid phase in the area that this antibody is directed against. So if this antibody is directed against, this is 1, this is about 34, this is 84, if the capture antibody is directed more towards the amino terminal, you'll capture some of the amino terminal. But if it's directed sort of at the mid-terminal, like this one is, you're going to collect the mid-terminal. The next thing you have is the detection antibody. So you shake up the test tube, you pour off the serum, you have a lot of parathyroid with a lot of fragments connected to the solid phase. You then put in a second antibody, which is the detection antibody. In this case, the detection antibody is towards the carboxy terminal phase side of PTH, and this either lights up with radioactivity or immunofluorescence, lots of different ways to do it. You see, you have a detection antibody that's floating around. It bound to this fragment of PTH, but then you pour off the soup again. You wash it a few times, and all you have left is the solid phase with the capture antibody, the PTH, and the detection antibody. So in the first of all, we had carboxy terminal PTH assays, which were no good at all. Then we had amino terminal single assays, which weren't much better. Now we have the immunoradiometric assays. In this first generation immunoradiometric assay, you see what the problem is. You have PTH 1 to 84, and the capture antibody is directed too far up the PTH molecule so that certain fragments like 7 to 84, 10 to 84, 3 to 84, will be detected as native PTH. People realized this, and they developed antibodies against the very amino terminal. The newest generation of PTH assays connect by about 1 and span to about 5. Right over here, they have a detection antibody that's closer to the carboxy terminal. And since it's really the first 34 amino acids in PTH that are biologically active, it picks up only biologically active PTH. It's about 50%, 54% of the old intact PTH, and it's a much cleaner assay. The world is migrating towards using those cleaner assays. The next question you're going to ask me is, should we use the 7 to 84, since some people have shown that it actually is suppressive? Should we use any sort of ratios? There's absolutely no data, save for one study that cannot be repeated, to show that that ratio is of any clinical use. There is the initial study. It seemed to be effective. It seemed to make sense. No one else has been able to replicate that study. So at least we don't use any sort of ratios. We use a PTH assay that picks up very amino terminal, and carboxy terminal. We don't have bone biopsy data for any of the immunoradiometric assays with PTH. But anyway, that's how the test is done. It's much better. Questions? PTH, yes, ma'am. You're going to have to speak. Did anyone hear that?
You might want to use the microphone.
There's a microphone. I encourage you to... We're nice people. We won't say anything nasty. I don't even see Dr. Naren, so you're safe. I really hope he wasn't in the room. Yes.
Why wouldn't you consider a tertiary PTH?
Good question. Why wouldn't we not have thought of tertiary PTH? And we'll get through the differences in a minute. Because the patient hasn't been on dialysis very long. It takes a long time with tertiary PTH to have absolute dysregulation of PTH secretion and autonomous secretion. She was hypercalcemic the day she started dialysis. So while it's a good point, probably not this patient. We did a parathyroid scan, large nodule present below the left lobe of the thyroid. Chest x-ray was normal, mammogram was normal. We were looking for other causes of hypercalcemia. This is a subtraction scan. Some of you are probably still, some of your hospitals, you're probably still using them. First, you give the patient thallium, which picks up the thyroid and parathyroid. Then you give the patient technetium, and it picks up the thyroid. And then you electronically subtract them, and you see, I can't see it very well, but there's a parathyroid gland. As opposed to the sestamibi scan, which is on this slide, different patient, you see how much better the sestamibi scan is. So if your hospital's still doing the subtraction scan, ask them to buy sestamibi when you need to do your next scan. But clearly, this lady had a nice, this gland clearly showed up nicely. Surgery, she had a big adenoma. The other three glands were slightly hyperplastic. They took out, this surgeon took out 2.5 of the remaining three glands. Her calcium decreased to 7.9 and was 9.1 at the time of discharge. She had a little bit of hungry bone syndrome, which we give the patients calcium and vitamin D, just like you give the patients calcium and vitamin D to treat the hypocalcemia. So let's think about hyperparathyroidism. This case, primary hyperparathyroidism, autonomous secretion of PTH. Secondary, the parathyroid gland responds to normal regulatory stimuli. It's just the parathyroid is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's responding to normal regulatory stimuli. In refractory secondary, you have non-suppressible secretion of PTH after correction of the metabolic abnormalities. Remember I said every parathyroid cell has some obligate secretion of PTH? In refractory secondary, you can't suppress that PTH. And finally, in tertiary, you have this refractory secondary with hypercalcemia. Okay? That's, I think, pretty straightforward. You saw this picture before. There's a lot of iterations of this picture. It was actually started out as a pharmaceutical company slide set, and it's been played with by a lot of people, including myself. But just let's think about the pathophysiology, unless you're going to do this tomorrow. Okay, quickly. We ingest phosphorus on a daily basis. You can't excrete the phosphorus as your GFR falls, your serum phosphorus goes up. We said phosphorus regulates the 1-alpha hydroxylase. You have decreased 125D3. The high phosphorus also decreases the 125D3. This leads to hypocalcemia. The high phosphorus also leads to hypocalcemia. Decreased PTH secretion. Hypocalcemia increases PTH secretion. Causes the bone disease, but much more importantly, causes a phosphaturia which self-corrects. So as you're developing renal insufficiency, the high PTH causes the phosphaturia, and that regulates the system. Decreased 125 also leads to PTH secretion. Increased phosphorus also leads to PTH secretion. But by far, the best regulator is calcium. Last slide is just to show you that this occurs very early. It doesn't occur in stage 4 or stage 5. Let's look at this collection of patients in which the calcium, phosphorus, creatinine, calcitriol, and such were measured with each stage of CKD. Stage 1, creatinine's 1, GFR is 104, phosphorus is 3.1, PTH is 45, calcitriol is 45. Stage 2, a small bump in creatinine. The GFR fell from 104 to 71. The phosphorus isn't significantly higher, but the trend is already evident. The PTH is significantly higher. This high PTH is causing the phosphaturia, which is aiming to lower the serum phosphorus. You're not absorbing as much calcium and phosphorus because the calcitriol is lower. This also, this low calcitriol, allows more PTH secretion. But even in stage 2, we're seeing a trend which continues to stage 3, 4, and 5. The PTH continues to go up. The calcitriol continues to go down. This occurs early on. Even when the phosphorus is normal, the system, it's like looking at the temperature in this room. You don't know if the air conditioner's on or the heater's on. In this case, PTH is trying valiantly to control the phosphorus, and in spite of almost doubling the PTH, it can't quite get the phosphorus down to where it was. Is this elevated? No. Is this higher? Yes. There's study after study showing these trends. This occurs early, and we have to intervene, I think, early. Yes, sir. Well, if you have a good surgeon, and if it's primary hyperparathyroidism, there's usually a single adenoma, and you take that out. In secondary, there's several things that could be going on. Sometimes the surgeon disseminated the parathyroid cells in the surgery, and you get this systemic parathyroidomatosis, and it's very difficult to treat. And we've been using cinacalcet in that case, but it's impaired to treat. But that's usually the only thing. Sestamibi is pretty sensitive and specific. Yes? I think it's up to your surgeon. And if you have a really good surgeon, you're okay. Let him do what he wants, or her what she wants. But, you know, I'd never tell a surgeon what to do. Usually, they leave gland behind. I've seen a spectacular surgeon who does it. I don't care as long as they do a lot and have good results. It's not mine to tell a surgeon how to operate. Yes?
The slide that you show is basically, you know, repetition of the Neil Bricker trade-off hypothesis, Slatopolsky pointing out the 60 ml figure. The problem is we, the nephrologists, are not going to see those patients at stage 2. Therefore, what can we do in the sense of public education, or better yet, peer education, to begin to tackle this problem early?
So the question is, we're not seeing people in stage 2. What our hospital does, and I'm sure a lot of your hospital do, we report GFRs now. So the primary care provider who saw a creatinine of 1.5, who before just blew it off, now sees that the GFR is 50, they send us the patient. So I think that goes a long way. The other is education. Because we don't do it right doesn't mean it is right. We have to educate our primary care docs that they have to send us, they should send us the patients earlier. Some do, some don't. Some of the best docs I know send them the day before dialysis. You know, sir. Well, you're opening a can of worms. my own feeling, and then I'll let the rest of the people talk about it. I think we all need some vitamin D. I think there are some non-calcium phosphorus effects of vitamin D on immunologic function, lots of other things. And I think that's clearly beneficial. I think the industrial amounts of vitamin D used in an effort to lower PTH while raising calcium and phosphorus is probably not very good. You saw the results earlier of how the high phosphorus, high calcium are detrimental. My own feeling is we don't have to use those industrial amounts of 125D to suppress calcium and phosphorus, but yes, a couple of mics of Zempar, everybody. Let me pass it on that around the table. No, or anybody.
Well, going back to the stage two, I think we definitely have to educate the primary care folks to start the therapy, even if they don't want to send the patient to us, for activated vitamin D. For you were talking about 25D too?
We talked about it later, but as we talked about before, absolutely everyone should have the 25.
Right? Everybody should have 25.
Right.
The data that are starting to come in for treatment using the KDOQI guidelines, though, are showing, as suggested by Dr. Wolf earlier, that it's not that beneficial in lowering PTH. So it's probably, what we're recommending is that everybody should just go on 50,000 units of ergocalciferol once a month. This is very new, and I'll talk about it more tomorrow, but Miles, do you have?
Yeah, I was going to say, in terms of the active vitamin D story and its other effects beyond PTH, we're in an interesting pickle right now, because we want to give people a treatment, namely vitamin D, that might have a variety of biological effects, of which the patients are deficient very early on in kidney disease, and that at least in a stage 5 model has been shown to improve survival, and you have this enormous survival disadvantage in earlier stage, and whether you could extend that benefit back to those people by treating them earlier is unknown, but certainly very exciting. Having said that, the big problem is that the only biological assay we currently titrate our treatments to are the PTH. We don't know what dose will capture some of those other beneficial effects. And so in a sense, PTH management may be the least important thing that vitamin D is doing, yet it's the only thing we can link our therapy to currently. So this is an open story. I think it's certainly better now that we have other options for vitamin D treatments that have less of an effect on calcium loading and phosphate loading, because certainly that needs to be avoided.
But would you advocate everybody gets some vitamin D?
Even though we
don't have the endpoint to measure?
So the question is, would I give everybody vitamin D? And I say this cautiously, hopefully there's no KDOQI police in the room. But what I do in my own dialysis patients is I do give them a very small dose of IV vitamin D, even if their PTH is low. And now I'm biased by my own research, where we found that in people with a PTH less than 100, thousands of them who were treated, why they were treated, I have no idea. But when you look, there was a 15% survival advantage associated with that approach. Now, those people might get ridiculed now if they did that treatment today, but at least at that study, when we looked at it, it was a survival advantage. So what I do is I take that and extrapolate from that, and I'll give patients 1 or 2 micrograms a day, even if their PTH is 40. And quite frankly, anecdotally, the PTH doesn't go down with those baby doses. In fact, as the people get better, sometimes the PTH goes up.
Right, and I don't think you have any disagreement. We're replacing intravenously and not orally.
No, that's what I'm saying, intravenously.
Right.
At dialysis, I give it a couple of months.
Certainly no disagreement. Other questions?
This is regarding your last slide you showed about the stage 2 CKD when the patients start having phosphaturia. We do not recommend them, or we don't reinforce too much of low phosphorus diet in stage 2 CKD. And I always thought that if these patients, they're having slightly normal high level of phosphorus, but they're having phosphaturia, we should reinforce the phosphorus, low phosphorus diet, so that we can prevent intact PTH going up.
Right. So if you go back to Ed, the question is the role of a low phosphorus diet. Years ago, when I was in short pants for real, Ed Sladopolsky did a very nice study where he did progressive renal ablation and phosphorus, not depletion, but concomitant reduction in oral phosphorus intake in dogs.
and found that they didn't develop secondary or tertiary hyperparathyroidism, i.e. the phosphorus hypothesis of its importance. So what physician is suggesting is low phosphorus diet should be thought about. Absolutely. The downside of a low phosphorus diet is that phosphorus is ubiquitous. All protein contains phosphorus. It's very difficult to get someone to truly eat a low phosphorus diet and be adequately nutritionally sufficient. So it's a real conundrum. We find that if we really try to protein restrict the patients, by the time they get on dialysis, they're starving. So we try to tell them to avoid the high phosphorus foods, but my own feeling, and this is personal feeling, and we'll ask everybody else, I'd rather have them eat and not starving onto dialysis.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think, though, that begs the follow-up question, which is, should we be using phosphate binders in normal phosphatemic kidney disease patients? And that's something that we're actually studying, because I think this, if you take a step back and ask, what is the single trigger that leads to the development of secondary hyperparathyroidism and chronic kidney disease, nobody can tell you. Some people say, well, there's hypocalcemia, there's hypophosphatemia, and there's low 125, and these all contribute. But what is the single thing that triggers it all? Well, my personal bias, based on some of what you already heard, is that perhaps it's phosphate intake, a regular phosphate intake diet in the setting of decreased kidney mass and kidney function, that means that in order to maintain normal phosphatemia, secondary mechanisms need to be recruited. The one I'm interested in, perhaps, is FGF23. And then FGF23 excess that helps the PTH maintain normal serum levels of phosphate, in turn, inhibits renal-1-alpha-hydroxylase, giving you calcitriol deficiency. And so that would then change, if that's true, would potentially change our approach and support maybe not phosphate restriction in the diet because it's too complicated, and diabetes patients, you know, what else can they eat, right? They're already on a sodium, a fat, and all these other restrictions. And if you tell them now you can't eat protein either, there's nothing, they got to eat grass and cardboard. But perhaps phosphate binders might make sense.
Quick question.
Yeah, what do you, in terms of low intact PTH and giving vitamin D, don't you worry about adynamic bone disease, and what do you think about that?
Well, that's another, you don't want PTH to go too low. With the first generation immunoradiometric assay, KDOQI suggests 150 to 300. That's probably a reasonable goal. If you go much lower on PTH, you run the risk of adynamic bone disease. There's a conference coming up next month in Madrid, which focuses on the fact that we're not getting bone biopsies anymore. And we really don't know what the PTHs are associated with, especially now we have newer assays, the patients have newer vitamin D analogs, patients are on cinacalcet, and we keep treating them and we don't know what the bone disease is. That said, I don't worry as much about bone disease. I worry about vascular calcification because that's what's killing our patients. Last question.
Alkaline phosphatase is not so high. Alkaline phosphatase is not so high.
Right. It's not.
Why? This calcium level is very high, so the bone turnover maybe high turnover, but this alkaline phosphatase level is not so high.
Right.
Why
is the alkaline?
It should be higher. More high level of alkaline phosphate.
You're right. It should be. It isn't. That's why there's clinical medicine and there's textbooks. That's a real case. Thank you all for a lovely response. Have a great afternoon. Enjoy the city.